Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Thank you for your rich welcome. It's so great to be here. I just like Tony. He says nice things about me all the time. But all kidding aside, it's such a privilege to be here. And Tony is right. Montreal is less than 2 hours away. And so you guys are the closest church to us. And we're really looking forward to doing more activities together. And Dominique and I are very excited to be here. I'll be more excited as soon as I figure how to work this thing out. It's on. Okay, great. So yeah, we're very excited to be here. We have two adult children who are not here with us. They're in Montreal, and they have their own lives. If we want to see them, we feel like we have to set up an appointment. You know, and so tomorrow we're having we're having dinner tonight, tomorrow, all four of us, because we scheduled it. You know, that's just the way life is nowadays. So Dominique and I, we have been Christians for many years. I won't tell you the exact number as not to give our age away, but we were both converted in New York as college students. And so I did go and get a degree in mechanical engineering, and later on, in fact, more recently, I went to business school and got an MBA, but I didn't play in the MBA, no, I got an MBA. I can see how some people could mistake me too, right? Considering my size and stature. Really our passion is working with people. Our passion is working with people, and that's why we've been working in the ministry for so many years in New York and New Jersey and the Caribbean. I don't know why we left that place, but and now in Quebec for the last 6 years. And so we are loving our church in Montreal. So here's a picture of our two kids, Isaiah and Nina. Isaiah is 22 and Nina is 20. And so they are at church in Montreal this morning. And so we love working with our congregation in Montreal. We have a congregation of about 140 members. And people are just very warm. They're very loving, very warm. I don't know if it's the French culture. They're very emotional, okay, and very direct. And when it comes to the culture and the language, there's cause for conflict in Montreal. And so I think people would be very happy to hear that here in Ottawa, you guys sung a song in French. I'm gonna tell them that they're going to love you all the more because of that. And so 2019, with a momentous event in Montreal, we decided to have a 21-day fast, which culminated in an event we called a solemn assembly. So we had a 5-hour church service from 7 o'clock on a Saturday night to midnight. And we had Tony, we invited Tony and Melanie, and Tony kicked it off for us. And that's why the service was 5 hours, because Tony came and he was preaching. Actually, no, that's not true. Tony really challenged us. And what we wanted to do, you know how it's easy to get settled in your routine? So we wanted someone from outside of Montreal, you know, an objective person, to come and really challenge us out of our comfort zone. And that's what Tony did. Tony was God's prophet on that day. And he really challenged us to take a hard look inside and decide what we needed to change, so we could have a more thriving relationship with God. And I believe that event set us on a course for the rest of the year. And as a result, the church is growing in numbers and maturity, and the culture of the church has been changing. So I hope you guys realize how blessed you are to have Tony and Melanie leading your congregation here. I don't have to tell you that. So even from a distance, we have been so inspired by how God has been using them. And so I hope you appreciate that. And so before I get into my topic, I wanted to give you some context. In March of this year, I was privileged to be invited to the Vatican. And so I went to the Vatican to participate in this international conference on religions and the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. And one of the goals, a lot of the goals, in fact, have to do with climate change. I don't know if you're aware that this is a very hot topic today, pun intended. You know, everyone is talking about climate change. Everyone is talking about global warming and how it's affecting the planet. And all of us should be concerned. It's not just a political issue. All of us should be concerned. In fact, you may or may not know this, that because of climate change, the rise in average temperature is really threatening the way we live. Life as we know it. There are species that have become endangered because of that. You've got a rise, the rise of sea level that's causing flooding all over the world, okay? Destructions of habitat. And so this is an important topic simply because it's affecting lives around the world. Here are some facts, again, that you may or may not know about. 850 million people in the world go hungry every day. Did you know that? 850 million people. And this number is predicted to go up to 2 billion by the year 2050. And what's sad is that 33% of the world's food production is reported to go to waste. Okay? 783 million people in the world earn less than $1.90 per day. 428 million people around the world do not have access to clean water. Okay? And 7 million people die each year because of pollution. And so a lot of people are talking about this. And there has been conferences all over the world where people come together and they try to figure out a solution. There was a momentous event in 1987 in Canada, in Quebec, where a document, an agreement called the Montreal Protocol was signed. And it really gave people hope that there is a global sense of awareness, that people want to do something to save the planet. And so after that, there have been conferences year after year. A big one was in 2015, where they had the Paris conference, the climate conference. And what's unfortunate, and I don't want to be a doomsday prophet, but a lot of scientists are saying, yes, there have been efforts. Yes, there have been headways. However, they predict that if we do not change drastically the way we live our lives today, we have a 10 to 12 year period to avoid global catastrophe. I don't know about you, but when I heard this and I did my research, it really hit me hard. And I thought, as Christians, what does the Bible have to say about the environment? And what is our responsibility? Do we have a responsibility? Should we get involved? And so this is what I'd like to do over the next few minutes, present to you what I believe to be a biblical perspective on the environment. And there are three questions, three things I'd like to talk about this morning. The first thing is how we got it, okay? It being the environment, how we got it. Secondly, how we broke it. And thirdly, how we fix it, okay? How we got it, how we broke it, and how we fix it. So let's talk about how we got it. Actually, I meant to talk about this. This is a very passionate young lady from Sweden called Greta Thunberg, who was in Canada and is really making waves, not simply by her words, but her passionate actions and choices to save the environment. So the other thing I want to say is that this is often seen as a political issue, a left versus right, a liberal versus conservative. But I think it's a human issue. Yep. It's a people issue. And that's the way we need to look at it, because our choices will affect our lives for years to come. So how we got it, okay? The world, the planet, when we received it, if I can use such language, had nothing wrong with it, okay? It was perfectly designed for life and for enjoyment of life. Let's look at a couple of scriptures, okay, how we got it. And in Genesis chapter 1, and you can go and read the entire account, but I selected a few passages, a few verses on that. In Genesis chapter 1, it says, so God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish and the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves along the ground. And in verse 31, at the end of creation, it says, God saw that all he had made, and it was very good, and there was evening and there was morning, the sixth day. And so as the scriptures tell us, at the beginning, when God created the earth and gave it to humanity, it was good. It was perfectly designed for life and for the enjoyment of life. And this is something that we can take for granted. Dominique and I, we took a hike a couple of weeks ago in the Laurentian Mountains in Quebec. And this is the village of Mont-Tremblant. And as we went up that mountain, and obviously I was out of breath when we got there, but it was worth it because the sight was so breathtaking. And we took a few minutes to just quiet our souls down and pray and thank God for the beauty of nature. And this is something that we can take for granted. This is something that, because we have it every day, we can forget that the earth itself and the way it was designed is a reminder of God's love for us. And so, God created the world perfectly designed for us to enjoy life. There is a theory called the fine-tuned universe. I don't know if you've heard of it. A lot of scientists believe that there are some 26 physical constants, okay? Planck's constant, the gravitational constant. And they're saying that these were so specifically designed that if they were to be varied, even slightly, life would not be possible on Earth as we knew it. Yep. For instance, the distance between the Earth and the Sun. And they're saying if that was slightly varied, then the type of temperatures we would have on Earth would make life impossible. And they believe that all of this points to the fact of a God who's not just intelligent in designing the world, but a God who's also caring and designing a world that could sustain our lives. Yeah. Okay, and so my point is, we got it unbroken. Yes. Now, we all would agree that there's something wrong with the planet. There's something wrong with the earth. But we also have to take responsibility and say that humanity is the cause of it. There's nothing defective in the earth. It's our choices, our lives, that have affected the earth. But I'd like us to talk about how we broke it and how we're breaking the planet. And this is where a lot of people would say, it all started with the Industrial Revolution, right? And I'm not an environmentalist. I'm not a geologist, and so a lot of that is, I believe, is true. I think our reliance on fossil fuels, I think the way we've mined the planet and the resources of the planet, all of that is true. But I think from a biblical standpoint, we've got to go a little deeper to really look at the root of the issue. And I believe it all started in a garden. some story about a snake and a woman. And so let's go there. And the Garden of Eden, so the account in Genesis tells us, and I'd like us to read a couple of passages, starting in Genesis chapter 3. In Genesis chapter 3 and verse 1, it says, "Now the serpent was more crafty than any of the wild animals the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, 'Did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden?' The woman said to the serpent, 'We may eat fruit from the trees in the garden, but God did say, you must not eat fruit from the tree that is in the middle of the garden, and you must not touch it, or you will die.' 'You will not certainly die,' the serpent said to the woman, 'for God knows that when you eat from it, your eyes will be open, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil.'" And of course, you know the rest of the story. The woman took the fruit, and she ate of it, and she gave some to her husband, right? And so let's continue and see what God said to Adam. And God said to Adam, God said, he said, "Because you listened to your wife." Now, I think it's appropriate to say that in a different context, it's a good thing to listen to your wife, okay? In a different context, it's a good thing to listen to your wife. I just thought it'd be important, especially for Tony, to put that in, okay? It's important to listen to your wife. So it says, God says, "Because you listened to your wife and ate fruit from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat from it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat food from it all the days of your life." So a problem started in that garden. Now someone may react and say, "Wait a minute. Hold it. Isn't this overkill? So they just eat one fruit and then the whole planet has to burn? The whole planet is cursed?" And so that's why I think there's a symbolism here. There's more to the story. I think the symbolism is that the snake, Satan, the enemy of humanity, the great serpent, the dragon, tempted the first humans to live life according to their own rules and not according to God's rules. And so what this is about, it's about a choice. It's about making the wrong choice. It's about choosing to be God. It's about choosing to set God aside and deciding to live life according to their own rules, on their own terms. And this is a dynamic that has been at play since then. I think today we do the same thing. We think that we can do better than God. And we think that we don't need God. And so we choose to live lives, our lives, according to our own rules. And at the root of the problem, there's this human pride or arrogance that we don't need God. And I think that's the root of the issue here. Okay? The planet is hurting because humanity has chosen to not play according to God's rules, to follow their own rules. I'm going to share with you a couple of examples, one which is very close to home. I was watching this documentary about the historical development of Haiti's failing economy. And so I'm from Haiti. And you may not know this, that Haiti shares an island with its neighbor, the Dominican Republic. So you know that, right? Okay, so the eastern part of the island is the Dominican Republic, and the western part of the island is Haiti. It's the same climate, obviously it's one island, same topography, same soil and mineral, but one couldn't be more different than the other. If you've had the opportunity to vacation to the Dominican Republic, it's we wouldn't say it's a first world economy, but people are living well. It's lush, it's green. If you were to go to Haiti on the other end, it's not just poverty, but it's misery, and you can see it because there are barely any trees. And so on one side, on the eastern side, it's green, and on the western side, it's brown. And here's the fundamental difference. The Spaniards, when they colonized the eastern part, they integrated with the people. And they allowed life to go as it was before. When the French came, their harsh treatment of the locals decimated that entire population. And then they brought in slaves from Africa, and they ruthlessly exploited the land by cultivating year after year for decades the crops. And you may not know this, but Haiti was the third largest exporter of coffee in the 1950s. And in colonial times, Haiti was the largest exporter of sugar. And so Haiti was called the pearl of the Antilles. And the French colonizers just exploited it. And what that did, it triggered a cycle of poverty for centuries. With the soil so depleted, the people of Haiti could not cultivate as much. And so what the people in the rural areas started doing, they started cutting down the trees to make charcoal so that they could sell and make a living. And thousands of years before that, in Leviticus 25, God gives Moses this command. The Lord said to Moses at Mount Sinai, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, when you enter the land I am going to give you, the land itself must observe a Sabbath to the Lord. For 6 years, sow your fields, and for 6 years, prune your vineyards and gather their crops. But in the seventh year, the land is to have a year of Sabbath rest, a Sabbath to the Lord. Do not sow your fields or prune your vineyards. Do not reap what grows of itself or harvest the grapes of your untended vines. The land is to have a year of rest." And so naturally, the people would ask, well, okay, so in that seventh year, after the sixth year, if we don't sow anything and we don't cultivate, then what will we eat? And so God answered, he said, "Follow my decrees and be careful to obey my laws, and you will live safely in the land. Then the land will yield its fruit, and you will eat your fill and live there in safety." You may ask, well, what will we eat in the seventh year if we do not plant or harvest our crops? "I will send you such a blessing in the sixth year that the land will yield enough for 3 years. While you plant during the eighth year, you will eat from the old crop and will continue to eat from it until the harvest of the ninth year comes in." And so God created the world. God set physical laws. And as people, as humans, we decided that we know better, and we're going to do life according to our own rules. Another example is the rise of democracy in America. Let's call it this way. This is a gentleman of the name of Alexis de Tocqueville. Alexis de Tocqueville was a French politician and historian in the post-revolutionary era in France. And so the old system was that you had in French society, pre-revolution, the nobles, right, who were living lavish lives on the backs of the masses. And so that's what the French Revolution was. Let's just tear that system down and bring in a system that was liberty, equality, and something else, fraternity, right? So Alexis, who was a French politician, took a trip to America. Because why? In America, they just had independence, and they were starting a new system, their democracy. So after traveling extensively throughout the United States, he wrote 4 volumes entitled Democracy in America. And this is what he observed, which was really interesting. he was comparing what was going on in Europe with the revolution with what was going on in America. And what he noticed was that democracy and America could be adept at inventing new forms of tyranny because radical equality could lead to the materialism of an expanding bourgeoisie and to the selfishness of individualism. He said, in such conditions, we might become so enamored with a relaxed love of present enjoyment that we lose interest in the future of our descendants and meekly allow ourselves to be led in ignorance by a despotic force all the more powerful because it does not resemble one. What is he talking about? This is over 200 years ago. And he's saying that in France, the future was uncertain because the people had done away with the monarchy and they were looking at a new form of society. And so in America, apparently they were ahead of France because they had this idea of radical equality, a democracy where everyone is equal, no nobility. And so what Alexis de Tocqueville observed, he said that in such a world, everyone is equal. That's a good thing, right? So if everyone is equal, everyone can achieve wealth. And if everyone can achieve wealth, then the race is on. It's a race to exploit and do whatever you can to achieve wealth. And he said, could it be, and he was not an advocate of the monarchy, but he was saying, could it be that you're replacing a despot, a dictator, by another one that is more dangerous because it's more subtle? And what is that despotic force? It's the idea that the pursuit of wealth, the pursuit of happiness, the pursuit of the American dream, that everyone can live like the nobility in France did. And so this means that let's exploit the earth, let's dig for steel, let's drill for oil, let's amass as much wealth as we can, and in so doing, you do not think about the choices, your choices, and how they will affect the earth for future generations. What am I saying? I'm saying we have to understand that how we broke the planet, how we're breaking the planet, it's not only the multinationals that are responsible. And it's not just through the Industrial Revolution. I think you've got to go deeper. At the very root of it, there is this greed that animate that lives in us, and this desire to have more. The more we work, the more we can have. And the more we work, the more we feel like we deserve to have. And we take it for granted. Okay, I'm gonna make a confession. Okay. I didn't shower this morning. I hope you didn't smell me. But think about this. Think about this. 80%, 80 to 90% of the world's population would drink, or would kill to drink, the water that we shower with. We wake up every morning, we can take a warm shower, a bath, we have more food to eat than we know what to do with it. Yes? Yes. Most of us live, and I know, because I've been particularly privileged to live in the U.S., the richest country in the world, but also to live in Haiti, the poorest country, one of the poorest countries in the world. And we have such comfort, relative comfort, that we take for granted. And yet most people are not content with their lives. They want more. The reason that Walmart can keep putting things out. We were talking to Melanie yesterday that a Costco, anybody who loves Costco here? a Costco open in China, and in 2 hours, all the shelves were emptied. It just sold out in 2 hours. In 2 hours. And so the problem, again, it's not just the overproduction. You've got to look at our overconsumption. Okay? So how do we fix it? How do we fix it? So obviously, self-awareness. Obviously, we need to understand our choices, and I have a list of practicals. But again, I think it's deeper than that. I watched this. I have to speed up a little bit. I'm running out of time. I watched this play years ago in college entitled No Snake in This Garden. No Snake in This Garden. And it was a retelling of the Genesis story as to what would have happened if there hadn't been a snake, or what would have happened if there hadn't been a Satan, or if Adam and Eve had not listened to the voice of Satan. And the idea is that we would have had a perfect world. Okay, man would have chosen to play by God's rules. And most people are going to say, yeah, this is utopic. This is, you know, an ideal that we could never reach. But I argue that as Christians, this is our hope. As Christians, this is our hope of a perfect world. And I'd like to share a couple of passages. I remember when I was doing my MBA, that one of my fellow students came to me and he said, he knew I was a Christian. He said, what's the importance of heaven in the life of a Christian? He says, I know you're a Christian. If heaven doesn't exist, does that affect you? And I said, absolutely. Absolutely. I have a good life as a Christian. You know, I'm married to a wonderful person. I've got great kids. I've got amazing friends. I eat probably more than I should. And I have a great, comfortable life. But Paul says, if only for this life we have hope in Christ, we are of all people most to be pitied. Now, obviously, this is a different context than the first century Christians who were being fed to lions and lit up in the arenas. But I think Paul's point is still valid to us. As Christians, our hope is really heaven. Now, the Bible has a lot to say on heaven, and I don't have a lot of time, but I'd like to share a couple of passages. Peter says, in keeping with this promise, we are looking forward to a new heaven and a new earth where righteousness dwells. And there's a passage in Revelation chapter 21 that describes this reality, this new heaven and this new earth. And unfortunately, most people think of this when they think of heaven. A bunch of angels sitting on clouds with harps. But this is a classical view which is not biblical at all. In fact, the early Christians did not believe that heaven would be an existence where Christians with disembodied spirits would ascend to. Rather, their thinking was that heaven would be God descending to be with humanity. That's why the Bible talks about the New Jerusalem descending from heaven. And so heaven wasn't just a place. Heaven was a reality with the presence of God and his people. And so, here's what's interesting. So I'm sorry, I have to go through this quickly. When Jesus came back from the dead, when he resurrected, and this is frightened, thinking they saw a ghost, he said to them, why are you troubled? And why do doubts rise in your minds? Look at my hands and my feet. It is I myself. Touch me and see, a ghost does not have flesh and bones as you see I have. It is unarguable that Jesus, when he rose from the dead, had a physical body. Yeah. In fact, the apostle said, well, is it a ghost? He said, no, touch me. I'm not a ghost. In fact, later on he asked for some fish. Yeah. Okay? He said, do you have fish? A ghost does not eat fish. And so the scriptures teach clearly that as he is, so we will be. Oh, I'm saying all this to say that the Christian hope in heaven is not in an existence that is ethereal and abstract. It's everything good in this life with none of the bad. It's a new heaven. It's a new earth. It's a very physical reality. And so why is that important? If as a Christian, this is my hope, then my existence is not simply defined by my present. And so I don't have to live with FOMO. You know what that is, right? The fear of missing out. Because I'm not missing out. I've got this incredible hope waiting for me. And so my choices and actions can be a consequence of that. What's sad, and I'll read this quote, it says, it seems quite inexplicable, and this is a popular Christian author. He said, it seems quite inexplicable to me that there are some Christians who claim to love and worship God, to be disciples of Jesus, and yet have no concern for the earth that bears his stamp of ownership. They do not care about the abuse of the earth, and indeed by their wasteful and over-consumptive lifestyles, they contribute to it. If we are true Christians, these words should not be said about us. Because we don't live for the present. It doesn't mean that we despise the earth. No, rather we care for it because front center is neighbor, or children, or grandchildren. And so we deny ourselves by living lives that are full of contentment with what we have, because we look forward to a new earth and a new heaven. In other words, Christians should be people who care more for this planet than others, because we know we have better and lasting promises. And so we can afford, quote unquote, to miss out on everything this life has to offer us. C.S. Lewis said that if you read history, you will find that the Christians who did most for the present world were precisely those who thought most of the next. It is since Christians have largely ceased to think of the other world that they have become so ineffective in this. The more we think of heaven, and the more we understand that this is what, you know, Timothy Keller says that, do you ever wonder why sometimes your soul pines for a memory you've never had? You're on vacation, and it's great, but it's not perfect. You're in a relationship. It's great, but it's not perfect. And so your soul is always remembering a perfect state that you actually never had. And he's saying that what your soul is pining for is the restoration of life and the earth as God designed it. It's as if genetically you remember what the Garden of Eden was like. And you can never have that in this life. And so, this wouldn't be a true message on the environment if I didn't give you a few practicals. So, as Christians, what should we do? We should support environmental advocates. We should use sustainable forms of energy. We should switch up unneeded appliances. Purchase necessities from companies with ethically sound environmental policies. Join local conservation societies. Avoid overconsumption. Recycle, do composting as much as possible, and get more information. We cannot afford to stay on the sidelines and say, well, that's not an issue for us. No. We believe that God gave us the earth and it wasn't broken. We believe that our collective actions broke it. We have to be a big part of the solution and fix it. Okay? We're waiting for a garden with no snake in it. Until then, let's do everything we can to take care of this broken garden. Thank you.